Welcome back to Exploring Boys Education, a regular podcast produced by IBSC for leaders and educators in boys' schools around the world. I'm Bruce Collins, IBSC Director of Member Engagement. In this episode, we delve into the complexities of the manosphere and its influence on young men. But before we begin, IBSC Executive Director Tom Batty joins me again for the latest IBSC newsreel.
Thank you, Bruce, and welcome to all our newsreel listeners, be you heading to beach or bleak midwinter. With the festive season upon us, I draw attention to some IBSC treats. Amidst the cards, the latest edition of Compass will have recently dropped through the mailbox, with highlights of the great works of IBSC schools in advancing boys' education and providing choice for families. And the IBSC website bears tidings of the diverse range of glittering professional development opportunities now open for registration. In-person regional gatherings in South Africa, New York, and Australia, alongside online classes, ideas labs, and virtual events. In this final Exploring Boys Education episode of 2024, inspired by their IBSC conference workshop, we welcome Tanya Zalar and Dr. Philip Gaydon from St. Paul's School in London. As awareness of worrying data on boys and young men grows, so does understanding of the need for greater sensitivity to the signs they give us that they are struggling, and our responsibility for care and considered response. Bruce speaks with Tanya and Philip about St. Paul's values-based approach to boys' character development. Importantly, Tanya and Philip discuss how this helps boys critically assess online influences and engage in open conversations about the manosphere. Thank you all for ensuring the festive spirit of goodwill is shared across your IBSC community, for your generosity in bringing your gifts to the IBSC table for the benefit of fellow educators, and for your openness to learn from the gifts and journeys of others. I wish you a merry festive season of celebration and peace in desired measure. With that, it's back to Bruce, and with thanks, downstream along the Thames, to Tanya and Philip at St. Paul's.
What a privilege it is today to be speaking to Tanya Zalar and Dr. Philip Gaydon. Tanya is the Deputy Head Academic at St. Paul's Juniors in London in the UK, and Philip is the Head of Character Education at St. Paul's School. And I first encountered Tanya and Philip at Harrow School for the IBSC annual conference, and I sat in their workshop that focused on the manosphere and engaging with boys around some very important questions. And I was really blown away, Tanya and Philip, as I sat in your session and heard how you are approaching this work at St. Paul's. And I really wanted to share what you're doing there. Also, Tanya, you were so kind to contribute to one of our online classes, and that has been received so well. I'd love to have you both just introduce yourselves and what your role is at St. Paul's and what you are busy with day to day, but also why you are so passionate about this particular subject. Maybe, Tanya, we could start with you.
Hi, thank you for your kind words, Bruce. That's really good of you to say. So I'm Tanya Zalar. I'm the Deputy Head Academic at the Juniors, and I work with boys aged 7 up to the age of 13. Predominantly, my role is focusing on curriculum and the academic side of things. I also teach a bit of maths and geography. I'm really passionate about this work because, well, essentially, I really love the internet. I'm really into my gaming. I'm working online quite a lot, and it's something which the manosphere I've encountered quite a bit, I would say more in my personal life than my professional life, but I do see its influences in school probably more than my colleagues, because it is something which, yeah, I have that kind of personal resonance with as well. So that's me in a nutshell.
So my name's Phil Gaydon. I'm our head of character education at the senior school. So that means that we're working from 13 up all the way through to 18. Our head of character education at the junior school is actually a wonderful person called Rosie Ferris. So she's kind of my counterpart down in the junior school. In my day-to-day, I'm actually a philosophy and theology teacher. So I'll be teaching A-level philosophy, religious studies, GCSE, and our internal moral philosophy course, which I absolutely love. But with my character ed hat on, I'm looking at how we can incorporate character education across our curriculum in the kind of fabric of the school. And I line manage our diversity, equity, and inclusion team and our PSHE team, which is our personal, social, health, and economic education team, which includes things like relationships and sex education. So doing several things around that to try and embed all of the stuff that we're going to talk about today. And the reason that I care about this so much, I think, is, again, as we'll probably touch on a little bit later, is my own sort of exploration of masculinity and what it means to be a good man and a good person, and how I've got undergone that journey through my life, and how it's something that I see these pupils starting out on, but in a way that is influenced by so many more things than I had to deal with, and thinking that actually they're going through quite a tricky time with this and really wanting to help with that.
Well, clearly you're both very busy people and schools are busy places. So again, really grateful that you're giving up your time to have this conversation with us. And as I said before, I know our global audience is really going to benefit from your insights. I'd like to dive in and focus on, I think, two things that really struck me as I was sitting in your presentation at Harrow, and that is the whole idea of a values-based approach and also your understanding of character education. So maybe we can start there. Are you able to explain what you mean by those two things, a values-based approach and character education, and why they are important?
Yeah, so I think I should caveat this as well with my background is I'm coming from working a lot with the Jubilee Centre at the University of Birmingham and their program into character education and the decade or over a decade worth of research that they've been doing in this area. And it's informed a lot by their practice. And I want to throw that out there to begin with to make sure that no one thinks I'm spouting off stuff that I'm talking completely originally or anything like that. Even though the stuff we're doing differently here, it's anchored a lot in what they're doing. For me, those two phrases are very similar, but I kind of separate them out a little bit because when I started talking about character education, a lot of people immediately jumped to this very old hat public school, trying to just increase resilience through outdoor ed or, you know, getting kids into difficult situations in the wind and the rain and overcoming obstacle courses and that kind of character. Whereas really when I say character education, I'm talking more about literally the idea of how can we mindfully develop a person's character in the same way that we mindfully develop a person's knowledge of maths or philosophy or something like that and help them develop that. But also philosophically, the idea that knowledge is a tool, it's not something that is valuable in and of itself. And I've had many debates around that, but I believe it's not valuable in and of itself. It's something we use. And so character education is then integral to education in general, because we're not just imparting knowledge, we're then thinking about, and how is this knowledge going to be used by you? And so we need to focus on the kind of person you want to be and what it means to use knowledge well. And that's kind of one of the major goals of character education, is to see education in that light. And then in terms of a values-based approach, really for me, it boils down to two key questions, which is, what kind of life do you want to lead and what kind of world do you want to create? So the thought being that everything we do about developing your character, everything that we're trying to do to help shape you, is driven by those questions. For me, it recognizes this philosophical position, which is known as internalism, the idea that facts alone can't motivate you. So no matter how many facts I present you with, if you don't have an internal desire to do something with those facts or to be influenced by them in some way, then you're not actually going to change. You're not going to start acting in a certain way. Action has to come from something that's internal to you already. And I think it also puts pressure on us to clarify our own standpoints in terms of who we think these young people should be becoming, because we often hold those thoughts without necessarily critically reflecting on them or being aware of them. And it informs so much of day-to-day life, especially at a school, in terms of behavior policies and rules, and what we expect of students, what kind of world do we hope they create. And I think we're not going to talk about it today, but a big example of that is, for example, around the environment. So there's been a long history, especially in things like children's literature, but also in education, around you will be saviors of the world kind of thing. And the idea being that we think that you should become this kind of person. Mm-hmm. And so really, it's just important to make sure that we're critically reflecting on those things and bringing them to mind when we're making our decision making in school and designing our curriculums in school.
Thank you so much for just setting that great foundation for this conversation, Phil. The other part of this conversation, Tanya, that we're going to dive into is the whole idea of the manosphere. It's a complex and often controversial online space, a controversial topic. I wonder if you are able to break down what it is and why it's a cause for concern, particularly for young men in this day and age.
Yeah, absolutely. So as you say, it is quite complex, and it is an umbrella term for a collection of online communities that tend to discuss issues related to hegemonic masculinity, that traditional form of masculinity, misogyny, and opposition to feminism. They operate on a spectrum, and they range very widely in tone and purpose, from seemingly benign self-help spaces to more overtly harmful and extremist groups as well. And in terms of the groups that do make this up, there are four main groups. There are men's rights activists. They focus on perceived disadvantages faced by men, such as family court bias, but they will frame progress for women as detrimental to men within that conversation. There are pickup artists, and they're like your Andrew Tates. They share advice on manipulating women into romantic or sexual relationships, treating relationships as transactions or games. There are men going their own way groups. They advocate for disengaging entirely from relationships with women, believing women to be inherently harmful or manipulative. And then there are the group I think most people will have heard of, which are incels, involuntary celibates. They are a subgroup. They are characterized by resentment and anger towards women for perceived rejection, often prompting dangerous narratives of entitlement and blame. And in terms of how it operates, it used to operate mainly on the fringes of the internet, in quite specific forums, but it's grown to use more mainstream platforms now, such as YouTube, YouTube Shorts, TikTok, and Reddit, amongst others, to spread its ideas, often reaching boys and young men through innocuous seeming content like fitness or self-improvement tips. But these spaces, they share a common thread. They portray masculinity as being under attack, and they frame modern societal changes such as gender equality and feminism as a threat to men's traditional roles and identities. And in terms of it, why it's a concern, these ideas, they're often picked up passively through social media algorithms. And I think that young men and boys are being algorithmically targeted with this. Sorry, you'll hear our boys going out to play in a second if that's the noise in the background. And they're shaping how boys perceive themselves and others, reinforcing stereotypes that will limit their relational skills and their emotional growth. And it's kind of presenting a world where women are seen as either obstacles or they're seen as threats. And the manosphere, it creates distrust and division. And it's undermining that work that Phil's speaking about, that collaborative, respectful environment which schools aim to create. And over time, it can escalate into broader attitudes that impact boys' ability to form meaningful, equitable relationships with others, but also with themselves. And they can often spill into everyday interactions. So phrases like, well, why are women complaining about that? Because they don't have to go to war, or feminism has ruined everything. They kind of echo those talking points which are used in the manosphere, reflecting a very simplistic view of gender issues. And boys influenced by these ideas, they may challenge female teachers or peers, dismissing their input as less valid or questioning their authority. and they may avoid showing vulnerability, viewing it as kind of like inverted quotes, unmanly, which impacts their ability to engage in discussions about well-being or relationships. And I think it's really important to state here that these behaviors, they aren't always deliberate. They aren't always malicious. Boys may simply be parroting what they've heard within these sort of manosphere echo chambers without fully understanding or realizing the broader implications of them.
I love hearing the voices of the boys in the background, Tanya, so don't worry about that. One thing that strikes me, Tanya, around boys getting drawn into the manosphere, and as I've spoken to friends of mine who have sons and they're having these conversations with their sons, but also colleagues of mine in schools here in South Africa are really concerned about how boys are drawn into these spaces that you've been talking about. I wonder if you could elaborate a little on I think what you called in your presentation, the recruitment narratives that are used by the manosphere and how they might appeal to young men.
Yeah, absolutely. So essentially these recruitment narratives, they kind of align closely with those seen in other broader extremist movements. They essentially operate by tapping into boys and young men's insecurities, their frustrations, and their needs, unmet needs. And the narratives can often be framed as self-help or empowerment. They can promise transformations such as becoming more confident, successful, or physical and mental improvement, offering a way to sort of take control of their lives. Now, these things on their own don't sound bad. I mean, as a school, we are promoting confidence, we are promoting success and physical and mental improvement. But it's the way in which the manosphere frames these things, which is particularly difficult to get under the hood of. It's essentially about the manosphere leading boys to sort of think of their sense of self-worth being tied to that external validation, how they look, how they perform, how tall they are, how many followers they have, or how much attention they get. And again, the desire for self-improvement isn't the problem. It's that they are channeling all their effort into one area, they're neglecting their relationships with others, their character, and their impact on their world. And in this mindset, the world becomes a place for them to assert control, to act on others, and to prove dominance. And it becomes less about connection and more about competition over others. The narratives, they can offer validation of grievances. So messaging in the manosphere, it frequently blames external factors such as feminism, societal progress, for struggles that boys face, creating a kind of victimhood narrative. Within it, there's the heroic framing as well, with boys and men being often cast as protectors, reclaiming what's a perceived kind of lost patriarchal order, which appeals to ideals of honours and strength. There's a lot of anger and emotion used within the messaging as well, and content is emotionally charged, which can resonate with young men who feel disempowered or excluded. And they appeal to a desire for identity and belonging. It provides a sense of community for boys and young men with shared goals and language. And their content is crafted to feel relatable, crafted to feel approachable, starting with benign seeming advice and slowly escalating to more radical viewpoints. And the algorithms, they amplify this content on mainstream platforms, and they ensure repeated exposure and those sort of being sucked into an echo chamber. And the language and tone can create quite a stark us versus them mentality, portraying boys as under attack and needing to fight back. And they exploit developmental vulnerabilities, especially during adolescence, when we know about all of the changes happening, not just sort of physically, but within the brain as well, when boys are searching for identity, for belonging, and for meaning. And by validating anger and blaming others, it can pull boys further from inclusive and respectful views of masculinity and towards ideologies rooted in dominance and exclusion. It creates a feedback loop. Boys feel validated in their frustrations, leading them to engage more deeply with the content that further reinforces the views, and so on and so on. And in classrooms, these influences can shape how boys interact with teachers and with peers, making it harder to develop respect, inclusivity, and collaboration. And I know that I'm speaking here from data from the UK, and we've seen recently data coming out of the US election polls, but views between young men and women are becoming more and more polarized. And I think that this is something which is being echoed across a number of countries.
Really highlights, I think, the importance of boys' schools, teachers of boys, leaders in boys' schools to be both aware of the manosphere, but also put strategies in place to have great conversations with boys about the kind of people they are becoming. And so, Phil, you know, I want to get back to this idea of a values-based approach that you apply at St. Paul's. And I wonder if you can share how you see this values-based approach to character education working in practice to counter the influence of the manosphere, of some of those things that Tania has just shared.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the important things to bring together is, as I said, that character education for me and a values-based approach for me is based on what I said is a philosophy of internalism, that it's got to start with some kind of desire rather than knowledge. And I think that's nowhere more prevalent than in this case, because as Tanya's just amazingly outlined, there's so many things that are appealing about this messaging that tap into the desires of teenage boys especially, that it is incredibly seductive and motivating. And so we know, at least from our experience, so we know within this school, that going for the knowledge-based approach of, well, hang on a second, here are some facts and figures about the manosphere and the people who are leading it, just doesn't work. It can't combat that motivational thing, especially, well, for anybody, not even especially teenagers, but for anybody. And similarly, where you might want to take a sort of consequentialist approach to how we approach these discussions, that, well, hang on a second, if you do this, these are going to be the consequences, or a rules-based approach, a deontological approach, where, well, hang on a second, some of these things just go against the fundamental beliefs we have as a society, the fundamental rules in which you operate. Those things don't work either, again, because it's just so rooted in the desires of the boys who are experiencing it. And we know that a rules-based approach doesn't always work with teenagers, and we know that consequentialism doesn't always work with teenagers anyway, but just especially in this case. So I think that's, for me, where a values-based approach and a character education approach that's rooted in the questions of who do you want to be works, because you go in with those conversations first. You set up those conversations in advance of any major issue, and then you can anchor the conversations about whatever topic, in this case, the manosphere, in those. So if you say something like, well, hang on a second, over the past few weeks, we've been exploring the fact that you want to be the kind of person who is seen as respectful, who is seen as brave, or who is seen as being able to make autonomous decisions. But the way that we define those in our previous lessons, that seems to jar with what we're now discussing and what you're now seeing. So do you really think that a respectful, brave, autonomous young man would engage with this material in that way? Or even leaving it more openly, how do you think someone who's respectful, brave, open-minded, autonomous would behave in relation to this material? And is that what you're currently doing, or is that what your peers are currently doing? So I think, to take an example of this, like many schools, we were thinking about how to respond to Andrew Tate. And we're getting conflicting advice, as all schools were, that on the one hand, we had a group of people saying, well, hang on a second, you need to address this because it's being talked about so prolifically and explicitly that you have to address it head on. You have to address him and what's going on head on. And then another camp saying, no, that's to give him more clicks. That gives him more credence than he deserves. So sure, talk about the general problem, but don't name Andrew Tate. And I think we fell down on the former side because we thought all the pupils will know that we're talking about Andrew Tate if we start talking about this stuff, and there's no point dancing around that. But what we did is we did an introductory lesson, first of all, more about algorithmic targeting, cognitive biases, what's going on online, that tapped into our pupils' desire to not be manipulated, to come back to that character trait of being able to be an independent, autonomous thinker. So saying, well, you know, these are the ways that you're being manipulated online. And we know that's just true. And you, as pupils and people and young men who take pride in your ability to critically reason and not be influenced by these things want to know about this and want to know how to avoid these things, and essentially in some way to game the system, which I think they really enjoy thinking about. So then the follow-up lesson would then be, okay, so let's take a look at an example of this, a case study of this. That's going to be Andrew Tate. And that shifted the dynamic of the conversation to make Andrew Tate a example of something else, which we'd already then agreed on was something that they wanted to avoid because of the kind of people they wanted to be. And it meant that whilst the conversations and defensiveness around Andrew Tate still existed, as it did in many schools, it was difficult for them to find firm footing to push back on because of what we'd already set up. Now, it didn't go perfectly, and I think we'll probably talk about pitfalls a little bit later, but it did seem to gain more traction than other lessons that we might have tried. My idea of a values-based approach or a character education approach to this is to go through a series of stages. And I think the first stage really is, as I said, thinking about as a school or even just as an individual teacher, what kind of people do we want our pupils to become? What character traits do we want them to have? And, you know, all schools tend to have either their values or their stated character traits. We have ours. And so you may already have those things, but it's good to ask those things potentially even independently of the system that you exist in to understand yourself and what you're bringing to the classroom as a teacher. But then asking, well, what I'm probably going to ask my pupils to do when they think about these things is to define them, be able to explain them, give examples of them, give examples of people who embody them. And, well, can I do the same thing? So if I'm hoping that at the end of this, my pupils are going to come out as thoughtful, open-minded, kind, respectful, humble, resilient human beings, do I actually know what that means? Do I know what that looks like in practice? Can I explain that to the pupils if they ask me about it? But then fundamentally, can I explain why this character trait is a good one to have? Because with things like the Manosphere and with things like Andrew Tate, I think there is a very clear and explicit messaging around you should be this because it will allow you to achieve this. You should be resilient because it will allow you to achieve more money, get a powerful status which will attract women. You should be cold towards women because it means they will actually desire you more, or it will increase your social standing amongst your peers, which will ultimately lead to more money, more success. That's very, very clear and instrumental. Whereas if I say, well, why should somebody be kind? Sometimes that's a very difficult thing to explain to someone, especially if you're saying, well, actually, I expect you to be kind, even if it's to the detriment of your immediate social standing. And we need to find ways of explaining those things that are going to be able to compete with the Manosphere messaging. The other big thing for me, and this comes from what the Jubilee Center calls an Aristotelian approach to character education, which is there is no single character trait that will always be a virtue. There's always the possibility of any character trait becoming a vice. And I think that's really important for these conversations, because when we were talking about things like Andrew Tate, or we talk about the Manosphere and the messaging, especially around things like resilience, is pupils will say, well, hang on a second, this is a good thing. Resilience is a good thing. So why have you got something against this kind of messaging? And what we want to say is, well, while we believe resilience is a good thing, in fact, as a school, it's one of our five fundamental character traits, there's always a context in which resilience becomes a vice. Now, I'm also willing to admit that about kindness. So you can meet them on a level of, I'm willing to admit that we don't want you to become kindness robots. And actually, kindness can sometimes be to the detriment of yourself in a self-destructive way. And we have to recognize that's a vice. But I also need you to recognize that whilst resilience is a good thing, and we also believe it's a good thing, can you also appreciate that it can become a vice as well when it's used in a particular context? And normally they absolutely can.
And I think many schools are thinking about how to address this. And I love your approach, but you did allude to the fact that it hasn't all been plain sailing. So I wonder if you could share both some of the successes, but also some of the challenges that you might have encountered with this approach to addressing the Manosphere.
Yeah, absolutely. I think to start with the successes is those lessons, I definitely had some of the best conversations I've ever had with pupils because of the scaffolding that went first. It definitely allowed the pupils to engage with it and see it from a different lens. So in some cases, it did exactly what we hoped it would do, and it was definitely successful. Some of the challenges, I think, is that some of the pupils felt that those lessons themselves were, in some sense, manipulative. And I think that is something that teenagers are very sensitive to. How you get around that, I think, is over time. It's very slowly. And that is one of the challenges, is that this does take a long time to embed in a way that the pupils trust it rather than remain skeptical, that they genuinely think you're meeting them as a human being who is interested in them. But I think we have seen slow change. We have seen more engagement with this. But that also speaks to a different challenge, which is parroting. And I think we immediately saw that from some pupils, that once they see that something is important to the school, or once they see that saying certain things, or feel that certain things will get them in trouble if they say them, they'll start just parroting the answers that they think you want to hear. And I think that is an incredibly difficult line to navigate, an incredibly difficult thing to spot, and will always trouble this kind of education. And it comes back to the idea of character. When we say character education, what do we even mean by character? Do we mean they act in a certain way? Do we mean they think in a certain way? Do we mean they hold certain values? And there's some of those things we can test for, behavior being the most immediate one, but some of those things we can't test for, like, have they genuinely internalized, and do they genuinely believe this, and will they reliably repeat certain actions because it's embedded itself in the idea of who they want to be. And finally, I would say that masculinity is still a difficult topic to bring up with pupils. They do have a defensiveness around it for at least two reasons. One being that they're just not comfortable talking about it. And the second reason being that they are worried about saying the wrong thing. It's all obviously very individual to each pupil, but there's definitely a tension there that's a really hard space to sit in as a young man having these conversations.
Certainly a very complex issue to take on and to have conversations about. And as teachers who are involved in this work, I wonder if you have any advice for other educators of boys who are rightly concerned about the influence of the manosphere on the boys in their care.
I think, first of all, it's really great that anybody who's listening to this, they obviously care about it and they want to know more. Phil's mentioned a few resources, but I'd also like to flag, there's a site called xyonline.net, I think it's .net or .com, which also has a number of resources around this. But I think that cluing yourself up on it is the first step to understanding its appeal, and as Phil said, why it speaks to our boys, the desires of our boys. And that's why I think that boys' schools are really important, and the expertise that we have within our teams in teaching young men and working with young men, and how we're able to address this. Because boys, they are often gravitating to the manosphere content for connection, for validation, for feelings of belonging. And I think it's really important to consider those needs and address it without dismissing their experiences, because that could be very hurtful if they're seeking it out for those reasons. So consider and have questions and conversations about why it is being sought out. We could probably do a whole other podcast on this, but about teaching critical thinking and media literacy, and helping boys question content by asking who created this, what's their goal, what Phil was speaking to about, teaching boys about the cognitive biases that all humans have, helping them to understand that so that they can spot that emotional manipulation, because teenagers, they don't like feeling manipulated, as we've said. So if they can spot it in the content of others, then they might be able to work with that themselves. We also explicitly teach about algorithms and algorithmic biases and cookies and all of those sorts of things from early on in the school as well, so that they have that kind of understanding and knowledge about it. I think one key top quick tip, and this is me speaking personally, is that not to call masculinity toxic or refer to toxic masculinity. It instantly makes boys roll their eyes and turn off from the conversation. It speaks to what Phil has just spoken about in terms of them shutting down the conversation and not wanting to engage in it. And it isn't. And these boys may only be seeing one view of masculinity if they are deep within that manosphere. So within the school, celebrating healthy, inclusive masculinities and those views of what inclusive views of what it means to be a man, to be a good man. It's important, I think, to work with families and to support parents and carers in having meaningful conversations at home, providing tools to address these topics, such as online influence and masculinity as well within home life and family life as well.
Yeah, such great advice. I wonder about this idea of creating safe spaces for boys to have these discussions, particularly in boys' schools. I wonder how you go about thinking about creating those opportunities for boys to speak and feel that their voices are valued. You know, Phil, you alluded to the fact that often boys will stay silent for various reasons, or they'll just parrot off what they think you want to hear. And obviously we want to create opportunities for real, authentic conversations.
One of our character traits that we focus on is humility. And I think it's important to start from a place of humility and recognizing that, as Phil said at the beginning of this podcast, these boys and young men, they're experiencing things that none of us have ever really had to experience. This is all completely brand new. And for us as educators to recognize that we don't have all of the answers. And so it's about that recognition and modeling that with children as well, and showing them that their voices matter. So even if opinions are challenging, if they feel like they are being, I'm doing inverted quote marks now, which doesn't convey well on a podcast, but if they feel like they're being cancelled, I think that that is a way of them going, oh, you just don't understand me, you don't get me, and so I'm not even going to bother talking to you about this. So starting with curiosity, asking questions such as what makes you say that, what makes you think that, how might your sister feel if she were to hear that, to start unpacking their thinking without that confrontation. And I think modeling disagreement, being respective and constructive in whatever our roles are within the lessons, we can model that respectful and constructive disagreement, regardless of our role, so that, boys are feeling like they are being supported and not being shut down. And we as educators can start considering the kind of deeper meaning behind, all of this to support them better.
Yeah, I think on the conversational, constructive disagreement, building trust, all of those things, one of the things that I was involved in before I became a teacher was working with a group called the Philosophy Foundation. And they very much take a facilitatory approach to their discussions rather than a teaching approach. And I alluded to Socratic irony before, and that was something that really I worked with. There's a phrase that they use a lot in terms of, are you entering this space with a teacher hat on or with a facilitator hat on? So when you're having these conversations, are you genuinely taking the approach of, I want to know what's in your head, rather than I want to maneuver this in a way for you to guess what's in my head or look for the right answer in that sense? And I think that's a really difficult thing to do, especially when so many of us feel like there are moral principles at stake, or that there is harm that could happen if these conversations don't go well. But approaching this as a facilitator is really, really important, not as at least for me, a facilitator rather than a teacher or an educator. I think that a big part of that is asking, and this may be my bias as a philosopher, but asking, what's your argument? So if a statement is made, not immediately jumping to conclusions about how they got there or the reasons for saying it or anything like that, but having a check of, is that a serious answer, especially if they're trying to give something flippant to maybe get a laugh out of people. But if the laugh happens, or they say something controversial to get a shock response, having that moment of, is that a serious response? Yes. Okay, in which case then, what's your argument for that position? Why do you think that? And then let's talk about that. Because that allows them to have their idea accepted into the room, but it says, but I am going to push you on why you think it, and we are going to analyze those things together. I think in terms of setting up these lessons, though, I think that sometimes we shy away from throwing in the evidence about why this is a conversation we should be having. And I think it's one of the things as a school, especially in things like our PSHE curriculum, we're getting better at, which is actually there's nothing wrong with front loading a lesson with evidence. Like, this is why we're having this conversation. Mm. These are the things that we're concerned about. Are you concerned about them? How are you feeling about them? Yeah. Being responsive and say, okay, if these are the things you want to talk about, we're going to talk about them. And here's a list of all, so I am happily going to meet you on that territory and say, here are all the stats and figures that you're going to talk about, you wanted to talk about, so let's take a look at them. It becomes more of a safe space because you've shown a willingness to go away and create resources and engage with the things that they've brought to the room. When we're asking boys to express their emotions, or we're talking about expressing emotions more, for example, when we're talking about Movember or suicide rates amongst young men, mm-hmm. We often say we want you to express your emotions. The implicit message they sometimes get around the emotions we shut down, such as anger, mm-hmm. is then a contradictory message. Mm-hmm. So we're actually saying we want you to express your emotions, but we want you to express them in this way, which is actually a much more difficult message. And again, this isn't to say that I have an answer here. This is more of a, is a safe space, yeah. one where they express their emotions and we allow them to express a whole range of emotions? Or actually, are we saying this is a safe space, but only if you express your emotions in this way? And finally, one thing that helped me was reflecting on the role of banter and what role banter has in the classroom and has in a safe space. So there was a wonderful book called Working with Boys by Andrew Hampton, which had a chapter on banter that really pushed my thinking on this. And that I now feel like I have to go in with a very clear understanding of what role I think banter is going to play, because in some of my classes, it's part of a safe space. Mm. It makes them feel more safe as a group. And in some groups, because of the dynamics that are in there, it absolutely isn't. And it's not like we can have a 100% cast iron answer on the role of banter, but it is something to really think about what role it has in your safe space, especially if you're working with young boys.
You know, as I listen to you, I think it's so easy to possibly feel discouraged by the impact of the manosphere on boys' lives. And it's certainly, you know, Phil and Tanya, in the previous question, as I was thinking through what you were saying, I was struck by, you know, the intentionality we need to have as teachers of boys in having these discussions, not only in terms of the content of those discussions, but in terms of the mode, you know, the way we introduce these concepts to boys and have these conversations. But for folk who might be feeling discouraged by the impact of the manosphere on boys' lives, what are your closing words of encouragement for educators of boys?
I think, first of all, it's recognizing our privilege within these boys' lives. We are really uniquely placed to help guide boys in understanding themselves, who they want to become, and their responsibilities to others. And I think one encouraging thing to say is that it isn't about having all of the answers, but kind of guiding and facilitating boys, walking alongside them as they explore their values, as they make mistakes, as we make mistakes, and about supporting them to grow into men of character and purpose. And every moment that we spend with them is an opportunity to shape a future that is grounded in respect, in empathy and integrity too.
Yeah, and I think I would add two things. One is that I can't think of many, if any, boys who haven't expressed they want to be a good person. Mm. When you get into these conversations with them, they have a desire to be a good person. So the Jubilee Centre uses an activity sometimes called eulogy virtues, which is, you know, what would you hope that someone would say in your eulogy? We tone that back a little bit to when you leave a business or when you leave school or something like that. But they want to be decent human beings. They want to have these character traits that allow them to sit in positions of relationship with others, everyone in their lives, in really positive ways. And so whilst they're battling with a lot of things, the desire is there to be a decent human being. And that really, for me, is the nugget which we can hang on to and build upon, no matter how long it takes. It really does fill me with hope. And I think the second thing is Michael Reichardt, in a book called The Magic of Male Development, Getting Things Right for Boys, he sort of prefaced it with this idea that the crisis of masculinity is not something new, right? But for him, and I'll just quote him, the fact it's coming to a head is less of a crisis than an opportunity. It's more that we are ready to be honest about things that have been true for a long time. In that sense, there's never been a better time to be a boy, a more promising time, a time when there's a better chance that we will get it right for boys, that actually a lot of this is heading in the right direction because it's uncovering and unpicking and deconstructing things that have badly influenced boys and young men for a long time.
Well, certainly a positive way to end this conversation. And what has also been really positive for me, Tanya and Phil, is the opportunity to engage with you and your insights on this very important issue, but also the wisdom that you've shared, the practical tips that you've shared. I think, as both of you mentioned, there are probably parts of this podcast that could turn into other podcasts because this is such a broad conversation. But I want to thank you both for giving of your time and your expertise, and I think for challenging and encouraging those in IBSC schools who are facing similar conversations with boys. And it's just a great encouragement to hear what you're doing and how your approach is having impact on boys. So thank you for your time, and thank you for all you're doing for the boys at St. Paul's, and I think the impact beyond St. Paul's that your work will have in the lives and the practice of teachers around the world. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure chatting with you this morning.
Yeah, and thank you for the opportunity, Bruce.
Thank you for joining us for this important conversation about the manosphere and its impact on boys. Tanya and Philip's insights into the challenges and strategies for fostering critical thinking and value-based decision-making in young men are invaluable. Their emphasis on creating safe spaces for dialogue and empowering boys to become men of character provides a roadmap for educators seeking to navigate these complex issues. Until our next episode in 2025, keep on championing boys' education.